Welcome to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, the show where brilliant professionals share how to sharpen the universal skills required to flourish at work. Enjoy more career fun, wins, meaning, and money with your host, Pete Mikaitis.
Hello, and thanks for joining us here for episode 871 with Minette Norman. Minette has some excellent wisdom on how to cultivate psychological safety, how it's easier than you think and makes a huge difference. You'll learn one, the secret to high performing and high engagement teams, two, how to increase psychological safety in five steps, and three, what you should stop doing. So if you want to check out the show notes or the transcript or the links to items that we've referenced, please visit us at awesomeatyourjob.com/EP871. Now here's a bit about Minette. Minette Norman is an author, speaker, and consultant focused on developing transformational leaders who create inclusive working environments. Before starting her own business, Minette spent three decades in the software industry. Minette is the co-author of The Psychological Safety Playbook, Lead More Powerfully by Being More Human. Her second book, The Boldly Inclusive Leader, will be published in August of 2023. Big thanks to Minette for sharing her wisdom with us. And big thanks to our sponsors. Check them out. One sponsor to check out is Storyworth, who's offering $10 off your first purchase at storyworth.com/awesome. Whenever I'm thinking about meaningful Mother's Day gifts, Storyworth leaps to mind. Storyworth is an online service that makes it fun and easy to write an entire book of life memories and preserve them for years to come. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved ones a single life-related question that you pick from their collection, like, what's the bravest thing you've ever done? I have personally loved the prompt so much that I have refreshed their questions page many times. All they have to do is reply with their story. After a year, Storyworth compiles those stories, memories, and even photos into a beautiful hardcover book to provide a valued keepsake. Families love Storyworth so much, they've got 25,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot with millions of stories preserved. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll all cherish for years, Storyworth. And right now, you can save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/awesome. That's storyworth.com/awesome for $10 off your first purchase. One sponsor to check out is LinkedIn Jobs. Did you know that you can post a job for free at linkedin.com/beawesome? It's true, and it's fantastic. With spring having sprung, perhaps you want to revitalize your business this season with some fresh insight and talent. Well, LinkedIn Jobs has created tremendous tools to make it oh so easy and fun to find the right professionals for your team faster and free. I love how they make it so easy with their promotion and selection tools. LinkedIn is not just another job board. Nay, LinkedIn has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. Here's some fun facts. 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours, and small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs number one in delivering quality hires versus leading competitors. You can post a job for free at linkedin.com/beawesome. That's linkedin.com/BEAWESOME, as in you are being awesome. Be awesome. To post your job for free. Terms and conditions do apply. Now, here's Minette. Minette, welcome to How to Be Awesome at Your Job.
Thanks for having me, Pete.
I'm excited to talk about your book, The Psychological Safety Playbook, Lead More Powerfully by Being More Human. Could you maybe tell us, first of all, what does that term psychological safety mean?
I'm happy to. And I just want to say, first of all, that it is not only my book. I co-wrote it with the wonderful co-author, Caroline Helbig. So it was a 50-50 collaboration. And I want to say that up front. And let me explain psychological safety, because it does sound like an academic, geeky term. People throw it around a lot without always understanding what it means. So I will ground it in the idea that it's a belief or a feeling that in a group setting, I am safe to share my idea, to ask a question if I don't understand something, to disagree with someone else in the room, and to show up the way I want to show up, not trying to conform to the norms of the group, without fear that if I do any of those things, I'll be rejected, I'll be excluded, or I'll be seen as that troublesome person. So it's really this deep feeling that we have as parts of a group, whether we're in or out, whether our ideas are welcome or whether they're not. And if we think about it, we probably have all experienced both having psychological safety, like being in a team where I speak up, where I can share my ideas, where I feel like myself, and times where we've been in groups where we sit back and we're very cautious and we don't speak up because we think we're going to be shot down or we're going to be embarrassed if we say something here. So that's basically what it means.
And do you have a sense for, in the United States workplace in 2023-ish, roughly what proportion of professionals generally have it and don't?
I don't have a good metric to tell you. So I'm just going to go on anecdotal evidence, which is that it's less common than we would hope. So I would guess that probably less than 50% of team environments would consider themselves to be really psychologically safe. I worked 30 years in the tech industry, and I got interested in this work specifically because I would often be in meetings where, even though I was pretty senior, when I left, I was a VP of engineering at a large company, and I still would sit in meetings and go, do I dare speak? Do I not? I have something to say, but I don't think it's welcome here. So my own experience and the experience of so many people I worked with was that they didn't feel comfortable speaking up, or they didn't feel that they could be less than perfect.
And when you talked about being yourself, I think it's interesting in terms of just like the political climate. Like, it seems like in most mixed rooms, if you were to share a deeply held belief that was on one side or the other of the political continuum, there's a good chance that won't go so well for you. So is that sort of included within the umbrella of what counts as being psychologically safe?
Well, I mean, you have to also know the situation you're in. So if you're in a professional setting, you know, our book is focused on the workplace. So I'm not talking about the world at large in general, about how to have a conversation about politics with your family. But in the workplace, let's just ground us there for now. In the workplace, you have to know what is maybe just going to be a taboo topic in the moment and not go there. Like, if, you know, you're not going to say someone's a Trump supporter and someone's a liberal, like, that's probably not a good discussion in a team meeting about how the project's going. This is just going to go badly and devolve. So I think that if we are talking about work, you know, there's this idea of showing up as your authentic self. So maybe let's go back to that. Now, people bring as much of themselves as they're comfortable bringing to the workplace. And it doesn't mean you show up with your ugly colors if you don't want to show those ugly colors at work. And it means that also, like, when you think about women having to prove themselves in different ways than men, or people of color having only certain aspects of their experiences that they're willing to show in the workplace, I mean, we all have to decide for ourselves what we're willing to share. But what I'll say is that in a psychologically safe environment, you may be someone who has a very different viewpoint than the rest of the room. And you'll know that that viewpoint is welcome. And I'm not talking politics, so we're talking work. But let's say, and this has happened in groups that I've been a part of, we have all agreed that this is going to be our strategy moving forward. And then you see someone in the corner of the room who's got some odd body language. They're kind of sitting back in their chair, their arms are crossed, and you think you've all agreed. And then you, as the leader, you can say, hey, Alice over there in the corner, you're looking like you're not quite with us. Is there something else you want to add to this conversation? Depending on the level of safety in that room, Alice may say, no, no, I'm all good, even though you can tell that she's not. Or she may say, I'm seeing a risk that we haven't even talked about. What if we, and then she can share her thought. And then suddenly we may have a whole different discussion. No one has brought this other thought up. It's really important for us to consider what Alice just contributed, but she, you know, she wasn't quite sure her idea was welcome until she was called upon and invited to offer an alternate perspective. That, unfortunately, doesn't happen enough. And what I see happen a lot, this is both in teams I've been a part of and teams I've worked with, is that you have a meeting, for example, and everyone ostensibly agrees in the room. Here's our strategy. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to proceed. Then you leave the room, whether it's a virtual room or a physical room. And then there are the side conversations, the meeting after the meeting, where people say, you know, that's just never going to work, or I totally disagree, but they didn't feel comfortable speaking up in the room. There's something about those team dynamics that are not healthy enough to invite the dissent or to invite the, have you thought about this?
Mm-hmm. That's powerful. And I guess as I'm thinking about this, it seems like the authentic self component of the definition is, I guess it seems to me like to be like a higher bar in terms of that, like, or at least maybe that's just maybe I'm projecting my own viewpoint on things in terms of saying there's a risk I don't think we've considered seems perhaps less risky to me than sharing any number of, I don't know, things about oneself. Like, I remember someone shared, let's just say, any number of like self-disclosure things in terms of, I went to Burning Man, mm-hmm. or I went to an 8-day silent Jesuit prayer retreat. Or they're sharing sort of their lived experiences associated with what they're doing, what they're thinking, what they're passionate about in bringing their authentic self. I guess, depending on the contexts and the group, it may seem more or less risky to reveal either a work concern or a personal bit of life.
Yes, that is so true. And you know, you only reveal sort of, generally someone has to go first also with revealing. And so, for example, if you're a manager or a leader, if you reveal nothing of yourself, if you're very guarded, and we talk about this in our book, like taking off that mask of perfection as a leader, if you come across as, you know, I am just this powerful leader, I know everything, I don't have a life outside of work, well, no one else in your organization is going to share who they are outside of work either. And it's going to be this very stilted, artificial environment where people just show sort of a mask of who they want to appear as. But if you, in a position of any kind of leadership or authority, you show up in a more human way, and it doesn't mean, and this is where I think people get confused when we talk even about vulnerability, like it doesn't mean you have to share your deepest, darkest secrets, but to share something about who you are as a human being, or even that, you know, you've had failures in your life, you've had setbacks, you've had hardship, you have emotions, then you are more likely to invite others to do the same. And it usually does have to start with someone who is either seen as a leader or as a dominant person in the group, that if they can let down their guard a little bit, then others will start to feel more comfortable doing the same. But if you feel marginalized, whether you feel you're from an underrepresented group and you just don't feel like you're part of the in crowd, you are not going to be the first one to probably share who you are fully.
Okay. Well, so psychological safety, we define it. We got a vibe for what that looks, sounds, feels like in practice. And it sure seems pleasant. I'd like to be in rooms where there's psychological safety for folks. Can you unpack a little bit associated with the performance, team effectiveness correlates to having versus not having psychological safety? Just how much of a difference does it make?
Yeah, there is. And there is a lot of research on. I just want to unpack one word you said, which was, it sounds pleasant. Mm-hmm. And I want to just say that it isn't always like kumbaya, we all love each other all the time and there's never disagreement. In a psychologically safe environment, you can have debate and dissent and it's safe to do so. So you may not always feel like it's pleasant. It can be challenging, but it's challenging in a constructive way. So I just wanted to pick apart that word a little bit before I went further.
Okay, I hear you. So it might feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
But it's not like terrifying. Like I'm out,
exactly.
I'm unsafe, I'm outcast. I should polish up my resume now based on how that conversation went down.
Exactly. It can be like, I mean, sometimes when you have a debate, it can be very energizing, right? Because you feel like,
yeah,
Pete, I'm not attacking you personally. I disagree with your idea, but let's make this better together. That's actually really energizing, as opposed to like, that was the stupidest thing I've ever heard and you should be looking for a new job, right? Mm-hmm. So those are different ways to engage in dissent and disagreement. So yeah, so it's definitely enables you to have those hard conversations that may not always be comfortable, but they're more comfortable than they would be if we didn't feel safe with one another. So coming back to the question, though, of performance, there's lots of research, and certainly Amy Edmondson, who has done decades of research on the topic, has uncovered that performance is directly correlated to having a higher degree of psychological safety. And why that is because, first of all, people openly discuss risk and failure so that they can learn from mistakes more rapidly rather than being doomed to repeat the same thing over and over. If there's this stigma that we never talk about failure and we don't talk about risk, what happens is that we go dark on that and we hide from one another when things have gone badly, and then we'll probably just repeat those mistakes and failures over and over. And her original research, which I don't know if you've read her book, The Fearless Organization, but in her book, she shares that in her research in the medical field, that teams that had a higher degree of psychological safety had better patient outcomes because those medical teams were actually willing to talk about mistakes. And for example, in a medical setting, someone at a lower hierarchical level than, like, say, the surgeon could actually question, you know, I think that we're risking something here. Like, is this the right medication? Is this the right dosage? And they could question the surgeon or the doctor, even if they were not at the same level. Whereas in teams where, you know, there was sort of this huge hierarchical difference between doctor and nurse, the nurse would never challenge. And therefore, there would actually be worse patient outcomes. In the world of other kinds of business, what we see with a higher level of psychological safety is we see more innovation. And why that is because in an environment where you're trying to innovate and come up with new ideas, that will only happen if people are willing to share maybe a crazy idea, maybe an idea that seems like completely impossible. And that happens when people feel that my idea is welcome here. All ideas are welcome. And then we can refine them together. We can debate them. We can take the best nuggets from everyone's thinking, and we can shape that into something that's really greater than the sum of the parts. And that's the way I see a psychologically safe team, is that if you can really tap into that genius that is there, because everyone has their own way of thinking and their own experiences, then you can get something that is bigger and better than the individuals in the room could do, but only if everyone's ideas can come forth and everyone's voice is welcome and everyone is really valued in a group.
Okay, cool. Well, now could you perhaps share a story of a team that really upgraded their psychological safety and the cool things that came about from it?
Yeah. So I want to talk about a team that had a high degree of psychological safety that I worked with early in my career before I knew the term. And then I want to talk about like how I actually tried to do that in a team that I led. Is that okay?
Oh, sure.
Okay. So early in my career, I was in the software industry in Silicon Valley, and I was in a company, and we were a cross-functional team. There were about 8 or 10 of us on the team. We all had a different function. And we just somehow, without ever talking about these terms or anything, we listened to one another in a really important way, and that everyone's voice was equally weighted. And we took turns doing things like administrative work. Like in a team meeting, we would take turns who took the notes, because when you take the notes, you don't participate as much. We got to know each other. So to your point about your authentic self, over time, because we worked together and we met like daily working on our project, we got to know our little quirks. We got to know like who did what and who, you know, who was strong at this and who was weak at this. And we even got to the point where we could joke with one another about our little quirks because we knew each other enough that it was okay. Like humor can be very dangerous when you don't trust someone, but it can be very bonding when you do. So we were this amazing team. We put out the best product that division had ever put out ahead of schedule. Customers loved it. That was early in my career. And I didn't know that that was like a particularly psychologically safe team until I discovered the research on it much later. But then I was leading teams. And what I found in my group was that people all stayed in their lane. They were, you know, I had a bunch of leaders who reported to me, and they all had their area of responsibility, and they were kind of guarded with one another. And it took us actually bringing someone in, an outside facilitator, to start getting us to talk about what was it we could do together, how we were stronger together, how we could help each other. And it really wasn't until we shared more about ourselves, like our whole career journey or what was important to us in our lives, when we got to know each other, then we started to care about each other as individuals. And not just as like, okay, this is the head of engineering, this is the head of agile practice, and this is the head of training. Instead of our functions, we got to know each other as individuals. And we knew like, okay, so-and-so grew up here, and this is what he loved to do, and this is what's important to him in his life. And somehow then we could have the more difficult conversations. We could actually disagree with one another instead of this sort of false harmony. And we became a much stronger team together. But we had to consciously get to know each other as individuals instead of just as like, okay, we're showing up at work, we're our perfect selves at work, and we're going to be a gelled team together. It didn't work until we actually invested the time to get to know each other on a different level.
Okay, thank you. Well, within your playbook here, you mentioned 5 essential tools. Could you walk us through each one and tell us some best practices for using those effectively?
Sure. So yeah, we wanted our book to be, first of all, as short as possible, because we know that business leaders are busy people. And like, if you're like me, you have lots of business books on your shelf that you haven't finished. So we wrote this book to be as short as possible. And we have these five plays and underneath them are five moves and they can each be used individually. So you don't have to read the book sequentially. But the way we started, our first play is called Communicate Courageously. And, you know, for a leader, like the very first thing that we advise you to do as a leader, if you want to be a more courageous communicator, is to embrace the idea that you don't know everything and to invite other people to help you with your thinking. So if you get up, for example, and you give a presentation, the powerful question you can ask is, what am I missing? Because when you do that, what you're doing is you're inviting others to add on or even to dissent with something you've said, but you're saying, I am a human being like everybody else. I can't possibly think of everything there is to think of. And I am inviting you to contribute. And then, of course, it's really important that then you welcome other perspectives. If someone does say, well, Manette, did you think about this? Like, this seems to contradict your thinking, that you welcome the other viewpoints and that you get comfortable with, I am imperfect. I don't know everything. So that's a starting point. And of course, we have, that was just one of five moves under Communicate Courageously. But I thought I would just start with that one. So that's the first.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
What am I missing? What have I not thought of? That's another way of saying that. You can find your own language. But, you know, I think what's really interesting is I said that to a leader once and they said, okay, I'm going to ask if that was clear. And I said, no, because if you say, was that clear? What happened is everyone says, yeah, that was very clear because you're the leader in the room. It's not so inviting as saying, what am I missing? Then you're asking someone to contribute something back as opposed to a yes, no. It's really hard to say to your leader, no, you were completely unclear just now. I didn't understand you, right? So that's our first play. Our second one is about listening because we really believe that listening is, you know, it's something that we think we all know how to do well as human beings. Like even just forget about even being a leader or a manager or anyone in the workplace. We think as human beings, we all know how to listen, that it's an innate skill. But what happens is there's so many things that get in the way of us listening to one another well. And it's a critical skill for everyone because first of all, as human beings, we need to be heard. We want to be heard. We want to be valued, right? And if you are sitting in front of me and first of all, you're distracted by something else, I know you're not listening. But what also happens, and this is so hard to overcome, is that we, instead of listening, we are preparing our response. So as soon as you start talking, Pete, I've heard the first thing you said, and I'm already reflecting on what I'm going to say next. But instead, the powerful thing to do is to truly stay with the person and just like listen, maybe ask a clarifying question to make sure you really understood them. And then only when you've fully heard them, then you can say, okay, maybe I'll share my perspective now instead of this need to just come up with our response right away. And then this leads into the third play, which is managing our reactions. So let's say we're listening and you challenge me, you know, you may say something to me that feels like you just disagreed with me or you dissed me or you made me feel stupid for something and I get defensive. And that is, again, this is human biology. Every human being will get defensive because this is our brain's way of keeping us alive and safe. And we don't differentiate between a physical threat, like I'm about to get hit by a bicycle in the road and I jump back, and my boss just criticized me in public. So to our brains, what just happened then is a threat. And what happens then is that our amygdala fires and kicks in with the fight, flight, or freeze reaction to keep us safe. This doesn't serve us well in a work setting. Because when we get defensive, what do we usually do? We lash out at the other person or we freeze because we just don't know what to say. And we can actually practice, and we talk about this in the book, we can practice. We can't stop ourselves from getting defensive, but we can practice how we respond. And one of the most powerful things we can do is to just pause. So if someone says to you, you know, that is just a ridiculous idea that's never going to work, you're about to get angry with them. And then instead you go, huh, okay, let me take a moment. Let me come back and let me say, can you say more about that? I really want to understand what you just said. And then in that, it wasn't very long. Like I just took a little breath. I took a little pause. In that moment, I calmed my brain and I was able to continue in a more constructive way. So that listening, not letting the defensiveness take over, and responding productively. I will tell you, this was something I had to work on so much in a professional setting, and I'll probably be working on this the rest of my life. It's a hard skill to learn, to remember to pause, but it can change your relationships at work in such a positive way, because instead of it being this battle of who's right and who's wrong, it becomes a collaborative conversation and a real dialogue. So that's our third one, is managing our reactions and becoming more self-aware that we all have emotions, we all have reactions. And in order to handle ourselves better in a business setting, no matter what level we are in the organization, we can benefit from greater self-awareness and greater regulation of our response. So that's the third play. The fourth play in the book is about embracing risk and failure. And it's, you know, one of the things that turns out to be so critical in psychological safety that we can openly discuss the failures. And I mentioned, you know, in the medical setting, but it's really in any setting. And that one of the best ways you can do it is just to openly share your failures as a regular practice. Like, what went well? Of course, we want to learn from what went well and we want to replicate as much as possible. What didn't go well? What can we learn from that? And to make that a regular thing and thinking a little bit more like scientists. Scientists experiment and go in the lab and they know they're going to have a lot of failures before they're going to have success. And if we can think more like a scientist in any setting and realize that failure is going to help us get to the big breakthrough. And if we're not having any failures, we're probably not pushing the envelope enough. We're probably not reaching for as far as we could go with new ideas and innovations. And so destigmatizing the topic of failure and not making it like a finger-pointing blame game of who did that and why was that wrong, but instead, what can we learn from this? What did we do that we want to do differently moving forward? So that's a really big topic. And one of the things we share in the playbook is it's something that came out of the software industry that teams that I worked with used, and it can be used in any setting. And it's called the blameless postmortem. And the idea is that, like, after you've had a failure, like in the software industry, it's often an outage. Like, so let's say you're on Zoom and Zoom has a big worldwide outage. The Zoom team would go back and they would have a blameless postmortem to say, what led up to that? What happened? What can we do differently to prevent that going forward? That can be applied in any setting. And it's a great way for team members to not point any fingers, but instead say, what are we collectively going to learn from this? And how are we going to be better going forward? So talking about failure is not something, honestly, that I was used to in the workplace. And it's something that you have to get accustomed to doing and practicing. So that's our fourth play in the book. And then the last one is actually a really big topic. And it's the topic I focus most of my work on. It's about inclusivity. So we call the play using inclusive rituals. And what we're talking about there is creating an inclusive culture. And psychological safety is truly the foundation for inclusion. So if you think about, there's so much talk, of course, about diversity, equity, and inclusion in the world today and in the workplace. And it's often focused on hiring a diverse workforce. And if it stops at that, you will not actually, as an organization, benefit from the diversity that you have in your teams, because without a safe culture and without an inclusive culture, people who feel different will just conform to the group norms and they won't even show up with any differences. They won't share their opinions. They won't share their experiences. So we introduce the idea of inclusive rituals, and we start with how you run your meetings, because meetings is how, you know, we spend so much of our time in meetings. And meetings are often a very much a sort of an expression of an organizational culture. Like how we show up in meetings, often what you see is that in a meeting of 8 or 10 people, there are 2 people who do most of the talking and the other 6 or 8 people who sit back and are fairly quiet. And if you want to truly create an inclusive environment, you have to find a way to bring in those other quiet voices. And there are different techniques for doing it. So we share some examples of taking turns, like doing actually a very, very deliberate turn-taking rule, appointing someone as a facilitator and taking turns playing that role so that you make sure you hear and invite all the voices. And then, you know, very deliberately inviting dissenting viewpoints as opposed to quickly converging on agreements, which don't usually lead to great outcomes or thinking things through all the way. So that's the fifth. And each one of these five plays with their five moves could be as complex as you want it to be or as simple as you want it to be. And we tried to make it very simple in that we give you ideas of what to put into practice right away. And then we offer further reading material if you want to go deeper on any of these topics, because they're all quite big topics, but we want to make it accessible and actionable. Like if I want to run a more inclusive meeting tomorrow, I'm going to use this rule, no one speaks twice until everyone speaks once. Try that out, see how it works. And if that worked, then maybe the next thing is you ask someone to play devil's advocate in the room. And then that brings dissent into the room. So just trying out things, experimenting with them, see what sticks, see what doesn't, see how you want to refine things. And that's how we really want people to think about this material, is that this is a toolkit for you to use one bit of it, you know, some bits of it, and find what works for you, but then keep consistently trying other things and trying to go deeper on this work, because it can transform how people feel about being at work every day and how they contribute and how much they feel they can do their best work.
Beautiful. Thank you. Okay. So we heard about the five plays. I guess I'm curious to hear the opposite in terms of common mistakes, things that many professionals do that are harmful to psychological safety. They might not even know they're doing it, but it can have a really damaging impact. Are there a few don'ts you would also highlight for us?
Yeah, there's probably a very long list. I'll come up with a few don'ts. So one, let me just start with meetings, since we were just on meetings, and then I'll work my way backward. Don'ts in meetings. So you know what's one of the ones that can really destroy psychological safety is someone is speaking and you interrupt them and you don't let them finish. And, you know, I've read research about this. I've felt this myself as a woman in a very male-dominated field. Women are interrupted three times more frequently than men in business settings and actually in all settings. So when you interrupt people, they start to feel that their voice isn't welcome. And then they go quieter because it's not worth the effort. So pay attention to interruptions, because you may, and it may be a very, very inadvertent and accidental interruption. So, you know, I just talked over you, Pete, and I can, and someone else, either I or someone else can say, oh, I'm really sorry I interrupted you. Please finish your thought. And then I'll come back to my thought. And just that really the small correction can make all the difference. Cause then I've just said to you, I do care what you say, as opposed to just talking over you and continuing. And then we never come back to your thought and you feel minimized and you feel excluded and you feel like you don't count. So that's one. I will say a really important one. And that is when someone asks you a challenging question, and especially if you're anywhere in a management or leadership position, it is so important that you not shoot them down. And that's when we get defensive. But I mentioned it before. It's one of the worst, most destructive things I've seen happen in a business context, is that someone asks a question and maybe it wasn't even meant to be a challenging question. They're brave enough to ask a question. And the person at the front of the room who's holding a Q&A session, for example, makes them feel stupid in the moment. Like, you know, I'm not going to answer that question, or, you know, that's a ridiculous question. I've heard an executive say that. That's a ridiculous question. So this is what happens. First of all, the person feels humiliated in front of their peers. But second of all, everyone else who witnessed that interaction suddenly feels like, oh, it's not okay to ask this person questions. They're not going to respond well. So you basically just shut down the people in the room. So be really careful with your responses in that may embarrass people or that may people make people feel less than. And, you know, if you get a question that you can't answer, just say like, oh, I'm not prepared to answer that question. Can you give me a minute? Or I'd like to come back to you on that. And thank you for the question. So there are ways to handle it that are going to increase the psychological safety. And there are ways to handle it like, that's a ridiculous question. I'm not even going to answer it. That's going to be pretty destructive. So that's one.
All right. Well, Minette, anything else you want to make sure to mention before we shift gears and hear about some of your favorite things?
Well, if anyone wants to learn more about the book, I will just say that we have a website. You can get some sample content. It's just thepsychologicalsafetyplaybook.com. And what we're finding is that there's so much interest in the book in all different industries. And that was maybe what was really surprising to us and fun to find out. We've been finding out about people in the automotive industry, in law, in HR, in insurance, in tech, and the food industry, and they're all finding value in this book. So what I want to say is that Psychological safety is important no matter where you are, no matter what you do. It's anytime you're dealing with teams of people, it matters.
All right. Well, now could you share a favorite quote, something you find inspiring?
Yes, and it's hard to pick because I have my selection of quotes around my office, but I'm going to pick one. And this is from Madeleine Albright. And it was something that I kind of heard later in my career, and it feels right to me today. And it is, it took me quite a long time to develop a voice. And now that I have it, I am not going to be silent.
All right. And a favorite study or experiment or bit of research?
Yes. Yeah, so this one comes out of UCLA, and I discovered it when I read a book called Social by Matthew Lieberman. It's about the brain, and it has to do with our brains recognizing pain. So they did these functional MRI studies on people, and they discovered that what they call, the researchers from UCLA call social pain, when you are excluded, when you are left out, and when you feel hurt, you're not part of this group. Our brains register pain in exactly the same way they register physical pain. So why is this so important? Because when we are feeling excluded at work, when we feel that our voice is not welcome, our brains are experiencing pain. And so I always say, like, we need to minimize the pain we are going through at work. People are suffering. And so that's why I think it's so important to create a culture of psychological safety and inclusion so we can minimize that pain that human beings are going through every day in the workplace.
All right. And a favorite book?
My favorite recent book is, I read constantly, but my favorite recent book is actually a novel that I think applies to the workplace as well. And it's the novel called Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. Have you read it, Pete?
No.
Okay. It's a great book. It came out in the last year. And it's about a woman who's a chemist in the late 50s, 1960s, and how she just plows through this male-dominated industry and does things on her own terms and with her integrity. And I think, and it's about speaking up and staying true to yourself. I think it really applies to the workplace everywhere today in 2023, and it's a great read.
All right. And a favorite tool, something you used to be awesome at your job?
Lots of software, simple software. But I will say the one thing I probably couldn't live without, what tool I couldn't live without, is Evernote or any note-taking tool, because I'm constantly reading and collecting ideas and coming things I want to come back to. So I put everything in Evernote so I don't lose it. Because if I write it in my physical notebook, I can't read my handwriting afterwards.
All right. And a favorite habit, something you do that helps you be awesome at your job?
I'm a big walker. I mean, I love to exercise in general, but I think walking is the best way that I clear my head. And I often get my best ideas and my clearest thinking when I'm just out for a walk.
And is there a key nugget you share that really seems to connect and resonate with folks? They quote it back to you often?
There's a quote from the book that comes back a lot that we've seen people quoting. So I'll just share it. It was, leaders tend to believe that they need to have all the answers and that they cannot show emotion. It's time to set aside those limiting beliefs.
Okay. And if folks want to learn more or get in touch, where would you point them?
If they want to get in touch with me, you can find me on LinkedIn or my website, MinetteNorman.com. And I already mentioned the book site, thepsychologicalsafetyplaybook.com.
And do you have a final challenge or call to action for folks looking to be awesome at their jobs?
I would say that small actions and small behavior changes can make a huge, hugely positive impact. So my call to action is just commit to trying one new behavior in your next interaction with a human being, in your next meeting. And it could be, you know, just commit to listening fully or taking a pause before responding. And you may be amazed by the changes you'll see in your relationships in the workplace, in your relationships in real life. So just try one small thing.
All right. Minette, this has been a treat. I wish you much fun and psychological safety.
Thank you. You too, Pete.
I really like Minette's perspective that leaders really don't need to have all the answers, and they can show emotion. And in fact, when you reveal you don't have the answers and ask the questions and reveal vulnerabilities, great things unfold. So again, the show notes, the transcript, and the links to items we've referenced are at awesomeatyourjob.com/EP871. Hope to catch you next time, and peace.
Thanks for listening. To get the most out of the show, we recommend two key things. First, check out the extra resources at awesomeatyourjob.com. You can find this episode's transcript and links, as well as the perfect episode for your situation. You can search the full text transcripts of hundreds of episodes or explore episodes tagged by topic and competency covered. Second, subscribe to the podcast and get future episodes automatically. You can subscribe by telling Siri and several other smartphones and speakers, subscribe to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, or by tapping subscribe in your podcast player of choice. If you'd like some extra help figuring out podcasts and how subscriptions work, visit awesomeatyourjob.com/subscribe for guidance. Hope to catch you on the next episode of How to Be Awesome at Your Job.